Blog Talk Radio.
On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, an armistice or temporary cessation of hostilities was declared between the Allied nations and Germany in the First World War, then known as the Great War. Commemorated as Armistice Day beginning the following year, November 11th became a legal federal holiday in the United States in 1938. In the aftermath of World War II and the Korean War, Armistice Day became Veterans Day, a holiday dedicated to American veterans all over the world of all wars. We're going to give you more information about Veterans Day and Remembrance Day with other countries in our second hour. And first, we're going to bring you a little bit of museum history and information with a very, very special guest, and also give you some tickets to a wonderful new place, Sojourner's Truth. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. Happy Veterans Day to you. You are listening to Focus on Empowerment, and we are glad that you have joined our show today. We hope that you will enjoy every single moment of it. Good morning to everyone, or good afternoon, wherever you happen to be. We are glad that you're listening to us. We have a number of things we're going to do today. We're first going to talk to a very special guest, Barry Gaither, who is the executive director of the National Center of Afro-American Artists here in the Boston area. We're going to give away some tickets, so pay attention in just a few minutes, and I'll tell you how you can win some very free, some wonderful free tickets to a new play called Sojourner's Truth. And then during our second half of our show, we will pay tribute to veterans all over the world and give you a little bit of history about not only Veterans Day in this country, but Remembrance Day across the globe. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. We're glad that you've joined us today. You can find out more about the Multicultural Symposium Series, the group that I started in 2008 that really focuses on multicultural issues, by going to mssconnect.com. That's mssconnect.com. Or you can feel free to give me a call at any time at 508-947-5755. Now, this is how you can get your free tickets to Sojourner's Truth. This is a great play that's going to air. It's going to debut here in the greater Boston area at Hibernian Hall next weekend, November 19th through the 21st. We have tickets for the show that will take place at 8 p.m. on November 20th. I only have 10 tickets to give away, or on Sunday, November 21st at 2 p.m. If you're going to be in the Boston area, if you're in this area, you will enjoy attending this play. It's being put on by Enchanted Circle Theater at the Roxbury Center for Arts at Hibernian Hall. That's on 184 Dudley Street in Roxbury. And again, the performances that we're giving away tickets will be Saturday, November 20th at 8 p.m. or Sunday, November 21st at 2 p.m. Send me an email. Send me the email to tellcarole, T-E-L-L-C-A-R-O-L-E, at mac.com. And give me your name, your address, whether you prefer the November 20th show or the November 21st show. And in 10 words or less, tell me, what does Veterans Day mean to you? So again, my email address is tellcarole, T-E-L-L-C-A-R-O-L-E, at mac.com. Give me your name, your address, where I can mail the tickets to you. And also, your telephone number would be helpful. And in 10 words or less, tell me, what does Veterans Day mean to you? That's our special giveaway for the day. It's going to be a great show. I will actually be there as well, and we would love for you to participate. I'm excited because our first guest is someone I've admired for quite some time. I have been to the National Center on a number of occasions, and I wanted to bring him on to let you know this is maybe a behind-the-scenes look. I sort of coined this as Museum Talk with Barry Gaither. So we want to find out a little bit behind-the-scenes activities that go on at his museum, as go on with many museums across the United States and beyond. And then we will find out what is cooking and what he's involved with, upcoming performances that will take place during the holiday season. Barry Gaither, welcome to the program. Glad you're with us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Super. We have people listening in the Boston area, across the United States, and around the world. So we're sort of globalizing this conversation, depicting you as a very committed curator, a museum director, representing museums like yours across the United States and beyond. Can you tell us a little bit about the National Center and how it came into existence? Barry Gaither.
The National Center of Afro-American Artists was founded in 1968 by the remarkable Elma Lewis, mm-hmm. who is one of the most outstanding daughters of the city of Boston in the 20th century. It was founded to promote and increase knowledge about the artistic heritage of black people worldwide. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, it has had three dimensions to it. Ms. Lewis founded the Elma Lewis School as a teaching division. We have not operated that for a while, but we anticipate being back to operating the school within a half decade. We also do performing arts, and the most outstanding of our ongoing performance arts works is Black Nativity, which we will do again this season and which we'll talk about later in the discussion. The museum is the visual arts portion of the National Center. Since the death of Ms. Lewis in 2004, I have been executive director of all of these activities. Prior to that, the museum was really my responsibility because I'm primarily a museum person.
Mm-hmm.
The museum's real goal is to celebrate the visual arts heritage of black people here in the United States, in the Caribbean, Latin and South America. We even have presented Afro-Canadian, Afro-European, and Afro-Asiatic works. So we try to help black people see themselves as a global population and at the same time to provide significant support for visual artists in our own immediate area.
That's a great overview of the center, and I'm particularly reflecting on the exhibit that I saw, and maybe you can touch upon this, maybe 2 years ago, where you featured Dominican artists. It was a wonderful representation of Dominican
artists. Yes, that exhibition was titled Merengue,
yes.
And it presented historical and contemporary painting, sculpture, and graphics from the Dominican Republic. The earliest works in the show were about 1935, and the newest works were around 2005. And we were fortunate to be able to bring that show to New England and to share it with all of our communities, including our substantial community of people who have come from the Dominican Republic or have connections there. It mm-hmm. was an opportunity to bridge across language and to express the commonalities that we share, all of us in this hemisphere, as black people, with connections to Africa and to the traditions that sprung out of slavery, whether they were in French areas, English areas, or Spanish areas, and to see what we have made of ourselves in the creative reinvention of ourselves that really has defined music and, in a very real sense, the visual arts for the world in the 20th century. It's hard to think of the music of the last century without thinking of jazz and Latin music, and increasingly it's hard to think of the visual arts without thinking of what we've contributed there. So that show gave an opportunity to express how the visual arts can tie together, without language, the enjoyment of a heritage.
You know,
showing a very interesting show, which is a different kind of tie together. It's
okay.
An exhibition of the work of Robert Peters, who is Afro-Wampanoag, and who lives in this area, and who has written a wonderful children's book called The Goody Monster. And we have on exhibit the original drawings that illustrate his book. He both wrote and illustrated the book. And it's a wonderful tale about a monster who's part bird, part lion, part dragon, and wears roller skates. And
he's
called the Goody Monster because he comes to children in their sleep and frightens away nightmares. And there is a little boy whose name is Shaka. He's introduced in an early drawing. And this little boy never gets visited by the Goody Monster.
So he
confides in his mother how much he wants to be visited. And she, of course, assures him that if he's patient, he'll get visited. But he is not patient. And he decides to go on a quest to find the Goody Monster. And he finds him on a mountaintop. And on this mountaintop, after he finds the Goody Monster, he gets disappointed because the Goody Monster works at night, going in dreams. And while he's talking to the Goody Monster falls asleep on him.
Oh, my
goodness. So in despair, he comes back down, and he eventually comes home, and he has to explain to his mother why he left without saying anything. And she warmly embraces him. He falls asleep in her arms, and then he's visited by the Goody Monster. And the moral of the story is that sometimes you have to go after your dreams if you want to be able to have them come alive. So it's a quite wonderful group of drawings, and it ties the African-American, Native American link together, drawing on folk traditions from both sides of that.
You know, it's a beautiful way that you have portrayed and you have showcased both the Dominican exhibit and this current exhibit by Robert Peters. I'm struck by an interview that I just heard from Quincy Jones, who talked about how powerful culture is and how culture is demonstrated by our arts, our music, and our food. And in many ways, what your museum is doing is the same thing, specifically in terms of the artwork. And I actually remember the Dominican performance that took place, the musical performance that took place. So, again, you're tying in those two as well. And they are extremely important to all of our cultures. Barry Gaither, this is in your blood. This is in your soul. We don't have to spend any time talking about how committed you are to this work. But in this day and time, what is it like to operate a smaller museum in light of this economy?
Well, I tell you, in 1987 or so, Miss Lewis was still alive, and we all were discussing the future. And we determined that we would never be able to flourish in the way that we want to, relying on shifting sources of support. And we decided to try to build a future that would rest more heavily on unrelated earned income. That gave us a first involvement with a vacant parcel in Roxbury known as Parcel 3. And we committed to trying to make that parcel key to sustaining a future for ourselves. Beginning in 2000, we worked on competing for the designation to develop that spot. And in 2007, we received a tentative designation to carry forward a mixed-use development project of roughly a $400 million project that would build a little more than a million square feet of space. But just as that happened, all of the financial markets were collapsing. We were able to get through that collapse, and in this year, we have found a financial partner, and have been moving forward in a very good way with the Redevelopment Authority, and we think that we can say with some certainty that around 2014, we will open a new facility at 58,000 square feet that will be paid for and completely outfitted. And more important than getting the new facility, we will have a relationship to the overall development project that will provide us with annual income. So for the first time, we will actually be able to pursue the ambition that we have to contribute in a much more substantial way to the whole cultural environment here. It will have been a decade and a half to get to that place, but we are confident that that is in our future. So our work is now at sort of two parts. We obviously have to continue doing the primary work, which we do with considerable struggle. I mean, I enter every budget year not knowing where I'm going to find what I need. It's a very difficult wrestling match. But we think if we can stay in place and continue to provide an important cultural service and support, that we will get to turn this corner and to become what Ms. Lewis visualized for us and what we as a people ought to have, which is a world-class cultural entity committed every day, every hour of every day, to celebrating and supporting the cultural contributions that we have made to the world. And, you know, that is where we want to get to.
That, you know, it's thank you very much for sharing that with us. And what I'm hearing, your model for success, for long-term success, is very much like the American Psychological Association, because they, too, years ago, got involved in real estate development, which sustained their organization, which has sustained their organization through the years. And I'm sure other nonprofit organizations have done that. So the genius and the vision of Elma Lewis, who I had the pleasure of meeting many times before she passed away, is going to be realized in the next, let's say, 5 or 6 years or so.
Yes, it would be true to say that over the last quarter century, not-for-profit organizations, many of them arts organizations, have all given great attention to trying to find unrelated earned income streams that could assist them in doing their work. And one of the real problems of it has been to find streams that are of a sufficient scale that they can actually support what you're going to be doing. And in our case, since we really started out developing the vision for Parcel 3 with in mind how it would endow a permanent cultural institution of the finest quality for Roxbury, we started out with a certain balance in mind. Unfortunately, we have been largely able to keep that in place. So I think it's going to be something that we and our children will all be very happy with. And people like myself and Ms. Lewis, who really took this on with no support really underneath us, we hope to be able to give the next group of cultural workers an entity that does have a foundation, and then they can raise it higher.
Well, that's we certainly wish you the very best. And if you have survived so far from the worst economic downfall in our lifetime, I know that this development of Parcel 3 will be a tremendous asset to the community, and certainly you'll be a model for nonprofits across the countryside, should I say. That's
yes,
excellent.
I look forward to an opportunity for the center to be what we would love to have it become, which is an oak tree under which many, many other things can survive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we can create a way to sustain a large cultural umbrella, we can do our work, but we can also provide a home and support for many of the cultural activities which we don't originate but which belong in the aggregate to our tradition. So I see that the benefits of being able to create this kind of support mechanism is one which we want to share widely with others who are as committed as we are,
right,
to seeing that the very best of Black cultural and artistic contribution is presented.
Well, with that said, tell us about Black Nativity, its history, where it has come from, and your upcoming performance in December, Barry Gaither.
We will be presenting Langston Hughes' Black Nativity the third week of December, opening on December 17th, with an evening performance at 8, and on December 18th, which is a Saturday, with a 3:30 matinee and an 8 o'clock evening show, and the final matinee performance on Sunday the 19th at Blackman Auditorium at Northeastern University. Now,
yes,
this show is a gift from the Black community of Boston to men and women of goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
It is the story of the Nativity told in the language and music of Blacks. Langston Hughes wrote the production,
mm-hmm,
in the early 60s, and it was performed off-Broadway around 1963. And then it toured, and the touring company came to Boston. John Andrew Ross, who,
yes,
was director of music for the National Center of Afro-American Artists,
yes,
was like a nephew to Langston, because Langston Hughes and John's father had been schoolmates at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania,
yes,
many,
mm-hmm,
years before.
Mm-hmm.
So when Langston came to Boston, he came to John's home. John saw the production and loved it, and John was an extraordinary musician.
Mm-hmm.
And Langston said to John that he wasn't entirely happy with the music yet. John created our production in 1970, and when he created the production, he changed some of the arrangements,
mm-hmm,
and we had at the time a very large creative staff at,
yeah,
the Elma Louise School on Walnut Avenue. So,
right,
we had George Howard, the gifted choreographer, who designed the choreography. And we had Michael Babatunde Olatunji, the Nigerian performer who really brought African music to large attention in the U.S. in the 1950s. And all of them were enlisted to create our show. So one of the things that came into our production was really new and extraordinary was George Howard, using the music of Olatunji, choreographed the birth and delivery of the Christ child as a very dramatic element with the pas de deux of the dancing of Mary and Joseph, and,
yeah,
with the delivery of the live baby in the context of the show. I always say, I don't know any other Christmas pageant where you actually are witness to the delivery of,
that's
the
right,
newborn Savior.
Right,
so,
right,
that became a very, very extraordinary piece in our production. John also introduced into our production the use of youngsters. The original production had been mainly with an adult gospel singing organization. And we brought to it the voices of youngsters, which have their own particular gleefulness and quality of delight and excitement. So our show, we first did in our space up on Elm Hill Avenue and in the fall of 1970, and we have done a production of Nativity every year since then. We have presented the show once before at Northeastern University. We've presented it in Tremont Temple downtown, and it has become a tradition.
Yes.
So I would urge everyone who wants to incorporate into their Christmas the joy of music and who wants to, by their Christmas activity, reaffirm how important the role of men and women of goodwill is in healing our society and making our communities safer. I want to get all of those people to come and join us again for the 2010 season of Black Nativity. As I said, it's at Blackman Auditorium at Northeastern, and you can purchase tickets online. The easiest way to do it is just to go to blacknativity.org, and there you will find details of all of the information and also an easy way to purchase your tickets.
Great. Well, that's a great rundown. I know countless people who have been in the performance through the years, including my own pastor who danced, Ray Hammond, who danced years ago. And
we still have a few people who have been in every season since we started the show.
Over 30 plus years ago. Wow.
40.
40 years now.
We have also some youngsters who are the third or fourth generation of their family who perform in Nativity. So it really does have deep, deep roots in this community and in Boston.
Well, it says an awful lot. Again, we have economic ups and downs and people come and go, but here this has become a staple, not just in the Black community, I think just in the metro Boston community.
That certainly is true.
It is witnessed, and it certainly is enjoyed by people throughout the country who come in, and certainly in the greater Boston area. And here it is, 40 years young and still going strong. That's terrific. Let me give the website again for those who want more information. It's www.blacknativity.org. That's Black NATIVITY.org, or you can call 617-585-6366. Barry Gaither, who you're the executive director, can you give us your contact information for those who want to find out more about the National Center of Afro-American Artists?
Yes, if you want to get a wonderful introduction to the National Center, to what we're doing presently, and a delightful glimpse into our history, you might visit our website, which is www.ncaaa3as.org. And there you will find our current activities, but you will also find an archive of the exhibitions that we have presented over recent years. So if you wanted, for example, to find something about the Dominican show that we mentioned earlier, you would find it in the archives for exhibits. You also will find a brief history there of the National Center and of the Elma Lewis School of Fine Arts.
Wonderful. Well, that pretty much completes it, and it makes me even more excited to want to see Black Nativity again this year, and to visit the National Center, certainly for the Robert Peters exhibit that's taking place, and for what you have in store for the community. I'm very excited about Parcel 3.
Oh, thank you very, very much. And thank you for the opportunity to share and to enlist support going forward. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Executive Director
Certainly.
Barry Gaither, thank you very much for being a guest on my program today. Barry Gaither is the Executive Director of the National Center of Afro-American Artists here in Boston. But clearly this is a 40-plus-year-old museum and center started by Emma Lewis, who passed away some time ago, about 6 years ago. 2004, Barry Gaither has carried on the mantle and is doing an excellent job, and I'm excited about what's taking place over the next 5 years. I can't wait to see the new center and see what's going to happen with Parcel 3. So, Barry, thank you very much again.
All right,
for being
thank you.
All right, take care now. Take care.
Bye.
Hopefully that'll give you an idea, because we're living in tough times. I know that there are people who have dreams and aspirations, and they're looking at the economy, and my goodness, we had a spirited show last week, and we'll have more spirited shows going forward about how we could cut the deficit, what needs to be cut, and there's a proposal on the table now, a bipartisan proposal that's been put forward. I know it's going to be hotly contested in the United States. And people are going to want to know, you know, how can we really get ahead? How can we move ahead? How can we present and create and preserve and protect small nonprofits, not those that get lots of funding automatically, Smithsonian-like funding? We're not talking about that. We're talking about smaller, regionally-based nonprofit organizations that are of great value in the community, great value. Culture, art, music must be a part of all societies because that represents who we are as people. Technology is great. It's wonderful. I'm a tech geek. But I also know, as a music major, I actually majored in music in college, I know how important music and arts and culture are in our lives, particularly as we age. So I just say hats off to Barry Gaither. He's a one-man soldier in lots of ways, because he keeps the museum alive. The exhibits continue to come. I'm going to definitely check out Robert Peters' exhibit, the Afro-Wampanoag, that is a Native American tribe here in the New England area. Check out not only the book, that would be a good book for my granddaughter, about the Goody Monster, but also the exhibit itself. So wherever you happen to live, there is a person, there is a small project, there is a visionary who needs your help, who needs for you to get on board and to help them to craft and create the kind of center that will represent the culture of your respective area. So I just say, if you're looking for free time, and I just talked to a parent some time ago where she wanted her young person to get involved in a volunteer activity, you may want to think about a small nonprofit that is perhaps struggling, but certainly has a lot of value that is of value to your respective community. You can give them a big, big help. And either with your time, your money, certainly getting to serve on their board, or figuring out a way where they can have this unassisted revenue stream that can carry them into the future. That was brilliant on Elma Lewis's part. She did an awful lot of great things in this community, and certainly her memories will continue to go forward. Well, let's take a little bitty break, and we'll come back, and I'll give you, again, information about how you can get tickets to Sojourner Truth. We'll be right back. All right. Well, again, the Enchanted Circle Theater here in the Boston area is putting on Sojourner's Truth. And for those listeners who don't know, Sojourner Truth was a well-known African-American freedom fighter in the 1800s. She just was born into slavery. She became an abolitionist. She was an outspoken woman. One of the quotes that she said was, "I will shake every place I go." She was a large woman, but just had a commanding presence, almost like the Elma Lewis of the 1800s. But they're putting on a wonderful play at the Hibernian Hall. It's the Roxbury Center for Arts at Hibernian Hall next weekend. That is Thursday, November 19th and the 20th and the 21st. The performances are as follows. The Friday performance will be on the 19th from 10 a.m. and also 1 p.m. And then Saturday, there's one performance at 8 p.m. And then Sunday, the 21st, the performance will be at 2 p.m. Now, typically the tickets are about $18 and students and seniors $9, but I have a couple of tickets that I'd like to give away to you so that you can be a part of this wonderful performance. All you have to do is the following. Send me an email. This is first come, first serve. So once these tickets go, then they're gone, and you'll have to go on and pay for your ticket. But you can go to send me an email at tellcarole, TELLCAROLE, at mac.com. Give me your name, give me your address, because I have to mail these tickets out to you, and then your phone number as well. I will know your email address because you will send me an email. And also, in 10 words or less, tell me, what does Veterans Day mean to you? What does Veterans Day mean to you? So very simple. Love for you to attend. I will be there next weekend, and it is a wonderful, wonderful play. Sojourner's Truth makes its Boston area premiere at the Hibernian Hall, featuring live music by Stephanie Marichaux. So it's going to be a great, great performance, and we'd love for you to be there. There is so much going on between now and the holiday season, not just here in the greater Boston area, but certainly around the world as we enter into a wonderful holiday season for lots of different groups and religious organizations as well. So very excited about that taking place. So we'd love for you to come. Now, we're going to shift gears a bit and talk for the rest of our hour about Veterans Day, and I've got a little bit of tribute music to play, and then we will begin learning a little bit more about it and realizing that Veterans Day is not just an American occurrence. It is something that is important around the globe. So we will talk to you about that as soon as we put a little bit more tribute music on in honor of Veterans Day, and then we'll come back and share with you more information about it. I had mentioned to you during my first segment that Veterans Day was actually started on the very close of World War I. Let me read a little bit more about this, and then I'm going to play a very short clip from Major General Joe Carter. I had the privilege of going to a Veterans Day celebration here in the greater Boston area yesterday, and picked up a lot of wonderful information about Veterans Day, about veterans, and particularly about women who have served in the military and are now veterans for the good, and even some disturbing information about how the homeless numbers are rising amongst women veterans. But first, let's give you a little bit of information about where it started. And again, it's a holiday that if you're not careful, you can just overlook it. It's a day off from work or a day to the mall or whatever, but it's a very important holiday. And in World War I, known at the time as the Great War, officially ended when the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28, 1919, at the Palace of Versailles outside of the town of Versailles in France. However, fighting ceased 7 months earlier when an armistice, or temporary cessation of hostilities between the Allied nations and Germany went into effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. For that reason, November 11th, 1918 is generally regarded as the end of the war to end all wars. Now, sadly, World War I was not the war to end all wars, but at that time, they were hoping that that actually was going to happen. My grandfather served in World War I, and my other grandfather was a minister at that time and was responsible for, he was on the draft board in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and was largely responsible for those in the, quote, colored community of Ann Arbor, Michigan, who would serve during that time. This was when the World War I was going on. Whether they would actually be given a draft deferment or they were drafted into the service. Well, in November 1919, President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, proclaimed November 11th as the first commemoration of Armistice Day with the following words: "To us in America, the reflection of Armistice Day will be filled with solemn pride in the heroism of those who died in the country's service, and with gratitude for the victory, both because of the thing from which it has freed us and because of the opportunity it has given America to show her sympathy with peace and justice in the Council of the Nations." Well, one thing led to another. One war happened, another war happened, and finally, this actually goes back to 1926 when Congress officially recognized the end of World War I, and it passed a concurrent resolution on June 4th, 1926. And then finally later on when we had World War II and we had the Korean War, and later that same year, this goes back to 1954, this is after the Korean War, later that same year, October 8, 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower issued the first Veterans Day proclamation, which stated, "In order to ensure proper and widespread observance of this anniversary, all veterans organizations, and the entire citizenry will wish to join hands in a common purpose. Toward this end, I am designating the Administrator of Veterans Affairs as chairman of a Veterans Day National Committee, which will include such other persons as the chairman may select and which will coordinate at the national level necessary planning for the observance. I am also requesting that the heads of all departments and agencies of the executive branch of the government to assist the National Committee in every possible way." One thing led to another, and now we have Veterans Day as a result of these various proclamations and signatures and presidents who got involved and recognized that we needed to somehow pay tribute to our veterans here in the United States. Let me just play a short clip that took place yesterday. Again, I went to a wonderful, wonderful celebration. I want to thank the coordinators who put this together. This was called Diversity in Motion, Veterans Continuing Success. It was at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, their Inn and Conference Center. And very special thank you to retired Lieutenant Colonel Oneida Blagg, who was the organizer of the activities. And she even talked about her life as being a military family member. But just a very short clip, and then I'm going to give you some statistics that you may not even know about Veterans Day, you may not know about the women, and ways that you can help our currently serving soldiers, particularly on the war front. No matter what you feel about the wars, the soldiers are out there trying to survive, and I will give you a sense of how you can help them. But before that, I want to play this clip by Major General Joe Carter, who I've known for quite a long time, have a lot of respect for him.
And Chancellor Dr. Romo, Colonel Retired Poppy, State Command Sergeant Major Costa, Dr. Rivette, Director Black, honored guests, esteemed veterans, ladies and gentlemen. At the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, after 4 years war and turmoil in Europe and 20 million casualties, by an armistice signed by the warring nations, the guns fell silent and World War I ended. That day, November 11th, originally known as Armistice Day, has become the holiday that we today gather to honor, Veterans Day. At 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, here in Massachusetts, throughout the Commonwealth, around the United States and the world, millions of people will observe a moment of silence in honor of those who have served our country and the cause of democracy. Among those many millions of veterans, both the living and the dead, are Massachusetts National Guard soldiers and airmen. From our very first formation on the Salem Common in 1636, through every major military action and natural disaster since, the Massachusetts National Guard has contributed to the defense of freedom and democracy. The Massachusetts National Guard is the oldest continually serving military unit in the United States military. Since its founding in Salem, Massachusetts, again in 1636, the Massachusetts National Guard has been a major presence in the history and the life of the United States.
Well, that's a little bit of history for you. I didn't realize until yesterday that the National Guard here in Massachusetts is the oldest ongoing military presence in the United States and represents very brave men and women who have served their country very well. Why is it important now to recognize the National Guards around the United States in every state? Because the National Guard, because we're in a period of a voluntary army, the war that is being fought in Afghanistan and the war that is winding down in Iraq are in part being served by National Guard members in every state in the United States who are being called into active duty and then have to go over and serve in Iraq and Afghanistan and then come back home and go back to work and then in some cases have to go back a second and third time. A big, big shout out to one of the top companies / organizations in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. They've been recognized as such in the Boston Globe. That's Lowell General Hospital. Lowell General Hospital has a policy where if there is an active duty personnel, a staff person who works at their hospital, then gets called into active duty, they are then protected. Their job is not taken away from them. They go into service, they come back, they have a job waiting for them. So I give them a lot of high props and credit for doing that. Now, when we're talking about Veterans Day and Remembrance Day, we're not just talking about that occurrence in the United States. It actually is being celebrated around the globe. And if you have access to the BBC America and you're going to see the news program today, as I saw this morning, you're going to see the commentators who will have a poppy on their lapel, the flower, a poppy. Well, that goes back to, again, Remembrance Day. That holiday, Remembrance Day, is observed on the 11th of November to call the official end to World War I. It was not just for the United States. It was for all the Allied forces. And the information I have here says the day was specifically dedicated by King George V on the 7th of November, 1919, that's in England, to observe as observance of members of the armed forces who were killed during World War I. and this was possibly done under the suggestion of Edward George Honey to Wellesley Tudor Pole, who established two ceremonial periods of remembrance based on the events of 1917. Now, that red poppy that I talked about, and I can remember as a child during Veterans Day, you wore a red poppy on your lapel or your clothes. When I was in school as a grade school kid, we wore these red poppies. And the emblem was a familiar emblem, of Remembrance Day due to the poem In Flanders Field. These poppies bloomed across some of the worst battlefields of Flanders in World War I, and their brilliant red color, an appropriate symbol for the blood spilt in the war. So if you look at many of the either current or former member countries of the United Kingdom, you are looking at Australia. They celebrate Remembrance Day. Barbados, Bermuda, Canada, obviously England, New Zealand, South Africa, and the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland as well. Other observances in other countries, France and Belgium. Armistice Day is a national holiday in France and Belgium. It commemorates, again, the armistice signed by the Allies and Germany in France for the cessation of the hostilities on the Western Front. Also Germany, there's a national day of mourning in the secular public holiday of Volkstag since 1952, and it has been observed for two Sundays before the first Sunday of Advent. In practice, this is the Sunday closest to the 16th of November. The anniversary of the armistice itself is not observed in Germany because they lost the war, okay? Each of the major German churches has its own festival of commemorating the dead observed in November. All Souls Day in the case of the Roman Catholic Church, and then there's also Eternity Sunday in the case of the Lutheran Church. Hong Kong, though not a public holiday, the Remembrance Sunday is observed in Hong Kong. Remember, Hong Kong was part of the United Kingdom, and I'm sure that that sort of has carried over all these years. It is marked by a multi-faith memorial service in central Hong Kong, and the service is organized by the Hong Kong Ex-Servicemen Association. So it's celebrated there, it's celebrated in England, in the Netherlands, in Poland, and clearly in the United States. So this is a worldwide phenomenon celebrating the dead, certainly the living, and those men and women who bravely protect our countries. And so that's a little bit of history with that. Let me share with you some history about women. I wanted to share that with you, but I think first let me just quickly talk about Native Americans who are extremely important in military service. They have served in all of our wars. In World War II, let me see if I can go back to World War I. This is information that was shared yesterday. Really appreciate it. World War I, about 12,000 American Indians served in World War I. 14 American Indian women served in the Army Nurses Corps. This is back in World War I. The Choctaw language was used to code messages to confuse the German code breakers. And in 1919, American Indian soldiers and sailors were granted U.S. citizenship 5 years before the Snyder Indian Citizenship Act granted citizenship to all American Indians. Because, right, American Indians didn't get citizenship, sadly, until 1924. So if they happened to serve in World War I, they beat the rush to citizenship by 5 years. So that's a little bit of history that you probably didn't even know, and I could go on and on. And eventually I'm going to put this information on the website, mssconnect.com, so you can have it firsthand and be abreast and apprised of your history that is important to you. But Yesterday we heard from retired Colonel Cheryl Lucier-Pape, who gave some really interesting information about women veterans and their service, which is certainly admirable and so important. But she shared some stats with us, and I just wanted to let you know that women veterans, I'll give you the top three or four states where there are women veterans today, where they're currently residing. The number one state is, what do you think it is? It is actually California. There are 166,709 women who are living in the state of California and who have served their country. The number two state is Texas with 155,625 women who, again, have served their country well. And the state of Florida is number three with 140,000 women who have served their country well. And Massachusetts is way down there, but we're in there nonetheless, with 26,085 women who have served their country well. The problem and the concern that Colonel Pape brought up yesterday dealt with women and how they are unfortunately rising twofold in some cases in terms of the number of homeless women who are being recognized for their current economic status. I asked her a question about that yesterday. I wasn't quite sure about why that number was so large. It has to do with the fact that there are many women who go into the service older. They have children. A large number of them are single parents. And so when they come out of the service, if in fact they had debt before they went in, and maybe they're not making a lot of money when they get out of the service, they incur more debt, they come back into this economy, which is quite staggering. One thing leads to another, and they lose their homes. There was a woman that was featured on Oprah. She was a veteran, a military veteran. She served over in the Iraq-Afghanistan theater, came back, had served her country, ended up homeless. She was living in a rented car. It was the saddest story I have ever heard. And Tammy Duckworth, who is the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, is certainly on her case now. I'm hope that by the time we are talking about this particular woman, she has housing. But to think that those who have served their country and have done so much for so many to come back homeless is just absolutely staggering and very, very sad. So you can go to a number of different websites. You can go to www.va.gov. That's probably the best website to go to, www.va.gov, Department of Veterans Affairs. Find out more information about current statistics, things that are going on in your particular state, how you can get involved. But two things I want to share with you. Number one is if you have someone who is currently serving over in Iraq or Afghanistan, no matter how you feel about it, this is what I did last year when one of our young friends was over in Afghanistan serving in the military, in the Army as a nurse. Thanks to Beverly Munn, who is a fabulous missionary here in the greater Boston area, serving at Charles Street AME Church, she suggested that we send this young woman an email, just a cheer email every week, which I did faithfully. Maybe I went 10 days or so, but she got an email from me every week or every other week just letting her know how things were taking place back at home. I didn't ask her any questions about what she was doing with her particular responsibilities over there, because it got ugly at one point with the bombings and the deaths that she was seeing. But I had an opportunity just to stay connected with her. You probably have someone that you can do the same thing for, and I would encourage you to do that. Just send them a cheer email. They have access to email. They would love to hear from their folks back home, and I would encourage you to do so. Secondly, Michelle Obama, our lady, has sent out an email today encouraging all of us to get involved with our military families who were left behind. Again, you can go, here's another website for you, serve.gov, serve.gov, and you can go there and find out how you can serve military families in your area. We know that the politics and the politicians, how things will go forward in terms of the wars that our country is involved in, but there are people involved in those wars. There are veterans, there are children, there are family members, and there are ways that you can get involved and you can let people know, I care about you, I am praying and thinking about you, and you certainly can do it in very personal ways. We say hats off to all of our veterans around the world for the service that they have done for us. We hope that you've enjoyed this show today, and we will see you next week for a very exciting show. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. Have a great weekend.